The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Blockbuster or B-movie, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Paul Manafort drama features a non-existent Putin relative, a mysterious professor, and almost $1 million worth of rugs. So what does the Russian government make of it?
It just sounds so much like the plot out of a B-movie, and they've been able to kind of exploit that in some ways to present to the Russian public as just being ridiculous and anti-Russian.
Plus, Major League Baseball's official suppliers of mud.
The Lena Blackburn Baseball Rubbing Mud Company, which has been the sole provider of rubbing mud to the MLB since the 1950s.
And remembering the forgotten in London.
It's very beautiful, it's love, and it's honoring the dead, and that's what you have to do.
The Crossbones Vigil and much more, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is the story in Washington. The first indictments in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation have rattled a lot of people in our nation's capital, especially those connected to the campaign that got President Trump elected last year. Now everyone inside and outside the Beltway wants to know what's next for Mueller's investigation. To start us off today, we're getting way out of that Beltway bubble to hear reaction from Russia and Ukraine, which both have starring roles in this investigation. The View from Moscow is coming up in a moment. First, though, to reporter Alexander Klymenov in Kiev, the Ukrainian capital. Alexander, what's the reaction there been to the Manafort indictment and his aide and the guilty plea from Mr. Papadopoulos?
Well, Marco, Ukrainians are really amazed that the Ukrainian politics get intertwined with the American politics in such a strange way. Of course, Ukrainians have heard the name Paul Manafort before. We've heard about him since about 2005, but nobody would ever think that at some point this saga, Ukrainian election saga that involved several presidents and several revolutions, would end up at the White House.
So between 2005 and, say, last year when Manafort was part of the Trump campaign, if you said Paul Manafort in Kiev, what would people think?
People first heard about Paul Manafort in connection with Viktor Yanukovych, who lost his presidential election in 2004 as a result of the Orange Revolution. And just about at that time, Yanukovych decided that he needed to change his image to make sure that he looks more pro-Western, sort of, not just this pure pro-Kremlin, very industrial type of man. So he invited these American election professionals and consultants and lobbyists, and Paul Manafort was the main man there, to work on Viktor Yanukovych's image.
So what did Manafort actually do for Yanukovych's image? Like, what did he look like before and what did he look like after?
Well, he was somebody who had served two jail terms in his teen years for burglary. And a lot of Ukrainians just couldn't get hold of this idea that somebody with that kind of past would become the country's president. And that's when Americans got involved. And Yanukovych really changed a lot. He started looking differently. He started speaking Ukrainian, even though he had only spoken Russian before. His speeches became more clearly focused. They became more pro-Western in messages, but he didn't really change inside. And a lot of people actually believed that he was a different man. Even some of my friends, some of the very progressive people that I know, were saying, I would rather vote for Yanukovych because he's a real businessman and I think he has changed. These people really want to move Ukraine westward, so he's a different man now. And he won, and then everybody realized that, well, no, he didn't change that much. He just started stealing and stealing and turning the entire country into just his pocket money, basically.
So Paul Manafort resurfaced last spring. Tell us what happened next.
Well, last spring, these ledgers from the party regions, which used to rule Ukraine for a number of years, surfaced. And they listed all sorts of payments that were done for political campaigns, for election campaigns, all sorts of bribes. And one of the names there was Paul Manafort, who was a consultant to Viktor Yanukovych and the Party of the Regions. And the amount that was mentioned there was $13 million. So it was at least that much money that Paul Manafort got from Viktor Yanukovych and his party for his services. But because those ledgers that were uncovered only cover a portion of the time, the amount could be a lot higher.
Alexander, I'm just curious how hungry Ukrainians are right now for any Manafort news, any news about the Trump collusion with Russia investigation. What do they want to hear?
Ukrainians are really hungry to get any news that would help end the war in the East with Russia. And a lot of Ukrainians count on the American help. So even the situation with Paul Manafort and President Trump, if it might put President Trump in a position where he would need to oppose Russia's President Putin, a lot of Ukrainians will feel happy because they will know Americans will be providing help for Ukraine.
Reporter Alexander Klymanov there with the view on the Mueller indictments from Kiev. So how big a story is this in Russia? Let's hear from Moscow now and the world's Charles Maines.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's a big story, of course, but the Kremlin view and what we're seeing here on state media essentially is that Russia's been just short of full exoneration on these Russia scandal charges involving interference in the elections. Of course, Russia's always said that they never were had anything to do with interfering in the American elections. And today we heard from, for example, the Kremlin spokesman. This is presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov, saying that he just noted the total absence of allegations against Russia in the indictment. He said this confirmed what Moscow has always said. It didn't interfere, and this was an internal matter for the U.S. And as we've kind of gone down the line, we've heard from Kremlin surrogates as well, for example, in the foreign ministry, talking about how this all piles on this idea that Russia's made for quite some time now, which is that Ukraine is hopelessly corrupt, and yet Russia always gets the blame. So that's basically the focus here, is that Russia has nothing to do with this.
What about your Russian friends, Charles? What do they believe?
Well, you know, I think a lot of them really look at this whole saga that we've been watching unfold over the past several months. And, you know, they do at times feel as though there's a little bit of hysteria coming out of the U.S. in terms of every little detail that's reported by the media gets sort of hyped. If some official meets with a Russian, it suddenly becomes a sensational headline. So I think there's a little skepticism there. I think also there's a tendency to point out some of the sloppier aspects of the American investigation. So, for example, if you look at the intelligence services report, this is the declassified report. You know, there were some simple mistakes made in there. There were some more mistakes, frankly, in this latest indictment that was presented. For example, and this was actually pointed out by a foreign ministry spokeswoman, that they noted in the indictment that Yulia Tymoshenko was the former president of Ukraine. In fact, she was the former prime minister. You've had other Russian delegates and essentially saying this is laughable, this idea of a foreign ministry representative meeting with this so-called professor. You know, it just sounds so much like the plot out of a B movie. And they've been able to kind of exploit that in some ways to present to the Russian public as just being ridiculous and anti-Russian.
U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that Russia carried out a massive influence campaign during last year's election here. We've got Facebook and other companies on Capitol Hill today testifying about Russian interference. What does Russia acknowledge about that?
They acknowledge nothing. I mean, it's been the same story again and again. And even as we've seen this kind of drip of evidence come out, whether we're talking about, for example, promoting anti-Clinton stories through social media, some of the political advertising, whether we're talking about this meeting back in June of 2016 with this Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, in Trump Tower with the president's son, Paul Manafort, and also Jared Kushner. You know, all these details, they've come up, which suggest, of course, that this idea of no Russia ties is already laughable. At the same time, the Kremlin seems to be sort of holding on to this idea of plausible deniability, which is a tactic you see often here. So they point out that these are all low-level meetings. These are amateurs. They didn't know Veselnitskaya. They deny ever having heard of her. And despite a lot of reporting that suggests otherwise, you know, I don't think you'll see the Russian government change their tune on this. And it is reminiscent in some ways of, you know, other stories where, you know, evidence would suggest otherwise, but Russia never acknowledges, for example, that they have, you know, its soldiers fighting in the Donbass in East Ukraine. The evidence in terms of the MH17 flight that was downed over the Donbass that suggests some kind of culpability by the Russians in that. Or, for example,
the Malaysian Airlines airliner that was shot down.
Quite right. And also just if you even point to the world of sport, look at the allegations of doping. You know, all these things, the Russians have their own alternative version I guess is the way to put it. And they're not going to change their tune.
The world's Charles Maynes in Moscow. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, a change of pace now. It's Halloween, and the world's Leo Hornack in London has a story of a ritual, the Crossbones Vigil, that began around Halloween more than a decade ago and now happens every month. Think of it as London's Day of the Dead, a time to remember forgotten Londoners.
It's a cold fall night in Southwark, South London. I'm on a small industrial road not far from the river. Once a month, they close this street to traffic and people gather. They come for a very special reason, to remember.
My son, he was 26 years of age. He got shot and killed in the Netherlands.
Maggie is one of about 30 or 40 people here tonight. She felt she needed this right now.
I was really grieving, and I just came here because I felt comfortable with tying his name on the gates.
The gates are really just an ordinary set of metal railings along the road, just to Maggie's right. Except that every inch of them is covered in ribbons and trinkets and photos from people like Maggie. It's a shrine to the people this city tended to forget.
This whole thing around here is very beautiful. It's love and it's honouring the dead, and that's what you have to do.
There's a reason this all takes place here. Those railings form the boundary to a wasteland that's become a garden. Through the ribbons and mementos on the railings, you can just make out a few lit candles. But in centuries past, it was a graveyard, the Crossbones graveyard. Everyone here knows the history. This is Alice.
Back in the day, it was the area of London south of the river where prostitution was permitted, bear baiting, the theatre, and of course prostitutes couldn't be buried in hallowed ground, so they were buried here. Thousands of them are buried here.
The graveyard was closed in Victorian times when the ground got too full.
Everybody in?
At seven, on the dot, the Master of Ceremonies, John Constable, begins the vigil.
Spirits of the dead,
spirits of the living, kindred, welcome to this, the 161st consecutive Crossbones Vigil for the Outcast.
Everyone holds a ribbon in their hands, each with a name written on it. Some names are taken from the historic records of London's poor, a market seller who died in 1723, a streetwalker in 1802. And some are the loved ones of people here today. When the spirit moves you, you read out a name and tie a ribbon to the railings.
This is the place of remembrance.
John himself is here to read the name of his friend Irving, who died last month. Irving's parents are here too.
Irving Rappaport, Mensch, 23rd September 2017.
Then others join in.
A man unknown from the workhouse, December the 4th, 1729.
Timothy Moore, son and brother, 2nd of September 2016.
Tyson Cochise Highness, son, 27th of September 2016, was killed, shot dead in the Netherlands.
And then John asks us to listen to the city accepting these names. And I find I'm crying.
The rumbles of the trains when they come by, the traffic, the planes overhead, the distant cries of voices, even my voice. These are only just things, that sounds that appear and then vanish in this beautiful, shining emptiness. As we stand for 1 minute in silence, holding the light to light the open pathways for all beings, dead and alive.
Our own Leo Hornack in London. Later on the show, interacting with the dead through bones and mummies. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. It should have been a moment of joy for Astros fans. Game 3 of the World Series last Friday. First baseman Yuli Gurriel had just hit a home run off of Dodgers pitcher Yu Darvish. But after Gurriel rounded the bases and entered the dugout, cameras captured him lifting the corners of his eyes with his fingers and using the word chinito, which roughly translates as little Chinese boy in Spanish, in reference to Darvish, who's half Japanese. Gurriel, who defected from Cuba in 2016, has apologized, and Major League Baseball is suspending him from 5 games next season, although he won't be missing any World Series games. But the debate over the incident is still raging. Julio Ricardo Varela is co-host of the political podcast In the Thick and founder of LatinoRebels.com. So first, Julio, tell us about Gurriel's apology. How did he explain his actions?
It was a typical apology. You know, I apologize if I offended anyone. It wasn't my intent. I'm sure it was very heartfelt. And I think Darvish also got Gurriel off the hook by saying it wasn't a big deal. Let's focus on baseball. But obviously the reaction online or amongst the community I'm around was quite different. I mean, they saw Gurriel as just crossing the line and it bordered on racism.
In your opinion, does the punishment of a 5-game suspension next season, does it fit for what he did?
No. I think MLB was weak on this one. I think they should have suspended him at least for a game in the World Series. I think if you talk to Dodgers fans and if you talk to baseball fans in general, the only people that are saying that Gurriel should not be suspended were Astros fans. You know, he actually hit a home run on Sunday that kind of led to this exciting game. And if he wasn't a part of it, you know, how would the outcome of the game be? You know, MLB talked a good game. But I think because Darvish said, well, it wasn't that bad, and Commissioner Manfred, I don't think he wanted to deal with the union. So this 5-game suspension that was happening for next year just seems a little bit out of whack.
You've heard the take, though, from several people, including an LA Times columnist who is half Salvadoran and half Japanese himself. They said that Gurriel shouldn't be harshly punished because racial sensitivities are different in the U.S. than they are in many Latin American countries. Do you agree with that?
I don't. And I think that's part of the problem with being Latin American. I'm originally from Puerto Rico. I was born and raised. But one of the things that I've done as a journalist, as a commentator, as a contributor at ESPN is talk about racism in sports in the Latin American space. It's kind of the ugly secret. We've allowed words like chinito or negrito, which means, you know, little black person, to be these terms of endearment, that it's all part of the culture. And, you know, this whole like, oh, we do it because, you know, that's the way we've grown up. I mean, isn't that what people used to say in the United States? Like, oh, that's what we used to do in the past. And I think what you're seeing in the reaction to the Gurriel comments, especially from young Latinos, young Latin Americans who are sports fans, is that this was wrong. Second generation Latinos that are living in the United States are kind of almost embarrassed about how we as Latin Americans kind of treat each other or label each other. It's almost like this dark stain that has never been discussed. And I'm actually seeing a lot more younger Latinos kind of taking the lead and saying that this type of behavior, no matter where you come from, is wrong. It's just wrong. And we need to call it out on our own, whether you're Cuban, whether you're Mexican, whether you're Puerto Rican. And I've seen more people speak out against than in favor.
So Gurriel, he's young. He came to the U.S. in 2016. Should he have known better, even if he was new to the U.S.?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that's what you hear, like someone like Ozzie Guillen, who's the former Chicago White Sox manager. He was on ESPN Deportes, the Spanish language version of ESPN, saying, well, you know, don't blame it on Gurriel. But this is 2017. This is the age of the internet. To feign cultural ignorance, you're a Major League Baseball player. You're playing in the United States. You've been there for a while now. I'm just not buying it. And I think a lot of Latino sports fans aren't buying it either.
So Dodgers pitcher Yu Darvish has tweeted that he'd like people to stay positive and move forward. Do you think that's likely? Or, I mean, it sounds like you're saying there should be a larger national conversation about this.
I think if Darvish and Gurriel want to kumbaya this moment, go for it. But I think there needs to be a conversation, a global conversation, especially, you know, racism is not talked about in Latin America. It's accepted. It's joked upon. It's innocent. It's just who we are. And that's changing in a lot of ways. When you're living in a bilingual, bicultural world, and you see in the United States it's becoming more and more Latino and more connected to Latin America, these type of conversations are making people uncomfortable in Latin America, but they're necessary. And if Darvish and Gurriel don't want to have it, don't worry about it. The Latino internet's going to have it, and they have been having it. If it kickstarts that type of conversation, I'm all for it.
That was Julio Ricardo Varela, founder of LatinoRebels.com. This World Series has also been in the news for another reason, a less contentious reason. The Houston Astros and Los Angeles Dodgers have already set a new record for the number of home runs in a series, and there's been a ton of speculation about why. Over the weekend, some anecdotal evidence emerged. Pitchers from both teams said the baseballs felt slicker than usual. Major League Baseball told Sports Illustrated that the balls which are produced in Costa Rica are the same ones as those used during the regular season, but an unnamed MLB source then speculated that the difference in texture might be due to some changes in the way the game balls get rubbed with special mud before games. Yes, some special mud. If you're confused, that makes two of us. Never heard of this pregame mud ritual before. Luckily, our reporter Carolyn Beeler has. So, Carolyn, help us out here. What's going on?
Sure, Marco. So, baseballs straight from the factory are too slick and slippery for pitchers to properly grip and throw. So, before every game, these balls get rubbed with mud to sort of grit them up and give them some more texture. And this roughing up has actually been done since around the 1920s when a batter was actually killed due to an errant pitch.
This mud, where does it come from, though? I mean, it's not just any mud, is it?
It's not. All the mud on all the balls in all of Major League Baseball comes from this one guy.
I'm Jim Bentliff. I guess you call me a mud farmer. I'm the president of Lena Blackburn Baseball Rubbing Mud Company.
That's the Lena Blackburn Baseball Rubbing Mud Company, which has been in his family for three generations and has been the sole provider of rubbing mud to the MLB since the 1950s. Now, I met Bentliff several years ago, and he took me to the spot where he harvests this mud. He made me promise not to say exactly where it was because this is a big secret in baseball, but I can tell you that it was mud from the bank of a little tributary of the Delaware River in southern New Jersey.
So why is this spot secret, Carolyn? Like, what's so special about the mud there?
I think it has to do with how Bentliff harvests the mud. He sort of stands in very shallow water and shovels off the top inch or so of this riverbank mud. So it's that very fine, silty texture.
It's the texture. It's like a cold cream. If it's too gritty, it can damage the leather on the ball.
So he shovels it into a bucket. And then he takes it back to his house where he filters it out, ages it in trash cans, and then packages it and sends it to the major league clubs.
Do we know if this mud, for sure, has anything to do with the current controversy over all these home runs?
So we don't. We know that a lot of players and coaches are saying that these balls feel different. So one unnamed source from the MLB has speculated that the difference might have to do with how these balls are rubbed down with mud before the games. But the MLB is not giving any sort of official statement on this. And the Houston Astros, who would have been responsible for preparing the balls for Game 4 over the weekend, after which all this controversy started, said they're not talking about baseballs until after the World Series. So they're just trying to stay above this controversy.
Pitchers get the rubdown after the game. The baseball gets the rubdown before the game. Carolyn Beeler, a resident river mud expert. Thanks for explaining.
You're welcome, Marco.
The top news headlines are coming up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on the show, we go on a global tour of catacombs, ossuaries, and charnel houses.
Traditionally, it's been much more common to keep the dead around, even in physical form, with the bones or the mummies, and to interact with those people, not cast them aside, but to keep them as members of the social group or even the family.
Happy Halloween on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It is an interconnected planet, and every day here on the show, we talk about those connections. Today, how a decision made here by President Trump has consequences halfway across the globe. The decision I'm talking about came in January, when Trump signed a so-called global gag rule, cutting off U.S. funding for any non-governmental organization that even mentions the word abortion. So what are the consequences of that for a country like Kenya, like health clinics in Kenya that provide family planning counseling, cervical cancer screening, and AIDS screening? They're at risk of losing financial support because of Trump's gag rule. Kenya is heavily dependent on U.S. health funds to fight HIV/AIDS and provide female reproductive services. One group that runs 16 clinics in the country is Family Health Options Kenya. Melvin Uyo and Amos Impano are here with me to talk about this global gag rule, as they've been doing for the past week with audiences in towns across America. So, Melvin, you're the clinic director. Have you and the clinic been complying with the global gag rule?
At the clinic level, we have not complied with the global gag rule because this is like committing suicide and just watching women die in your hands. And an example is, of course, we ran out of stock for contraception. A young girl who came, she didn't access her injection, which she always got through the outreach services. And as a result, she got pregnant. This was an unplanned pregnancy. When she came, she was so suicidal. And she's a 20-year-old, lives in a family of three, in living standards are very poor, with open sewer, no access to safe water. She cannot just afford to carry a pregnancy to term. And she just says, I will die if I cannot get assistance or service and safe service to be able to terminate the pregnancy. I took her through counseling and was able to refer her appropriately. And she was saved from committing suicide.
So, Amos, have you started seeing the effects of the global gag rule? Has some money started drying up?
Yes. As Family Health Options Kenya, we have already started seeing the impact of the reduction in funding. We have close to one clinic in the coastal region of Kenya where we used to provide family planning services. And so if we are to sign into the gag rule, it means then we are going to throw away our mandate of reaching out to young women, women who need family planning services. I can give an example of a girl who just a few weeks ago got pregnant, an intended pregnancy, and she is not according to customs to get pregnant. And when the mother went to the market, on returning back, the girl is dead. She just killed herself. This would not have happened if this girl accessed the family planning method. This is just an example of one girl and could happen to many other girls.
And when they get unplanned pregnancies, they either will want to terminate the pregnancy or they will carry the pregnancy to term. If they carried the pregnancy to term and they cannot be able to afford for the families, that will mean another trouble. An example, a young girl who worked in the clinic, she had previously had to go out and have sex for money to be able to take care of the family. And she got pregnant. She was forced to carry a pregnancy and delivered at 16 years. From that, she could not just avoid having sex for money because she has to survive within the slums. So she was referred to Family Health Options Kenya to be able to access a family planning method. When she came, I was able to provide a 5-year implant, and she went away happy and comfortable. And she says, once the 5 years are over, I'll come for another one because I now know the referral point where I can get this.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, too, the horrible case of being forced into prostitution to raise a baby. But there are other consequences that you didn't mention, like suddenly girls can't go to school as they might have wanted because they have to do these other jobs.
And actually, this particular girl, the moment she got that contraceptive, she looked back and she said, I'm going back to school so that I can be able to earn a living and take care of my children and as well as my mother.
What percentage of your budget is American money? And are there other avenues of funding that you can turn to kind of offset what will be cut from your budget?
Actually, Family Health Options Kenya does not receive direct funding from America. Our main grant comes from IPPF. International Planned Parenthood Federation.
Okay. So the U.S. funding goes through IPPF, which then disburses to you, but because of the global gag rule, they'll just be giving you less. Is that it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Family Health Options Kenya, you're in a really terrible dilemma. You will get all your services shut down if you continue to not abide by the global gag rule, but philosophically, it's in your DNA to continue providing these services. What are you going to do? Do you have any strategy?
Right now, the unfortunate thing that we are doing is that we are charging a small fee for clients who come to our services so that we can be able to sustain the interventions. And this is basically causing more trouble because, you know, we provide services in communities which are poor in the rural areas. We provide services to the communities in the slum areas, and they don't have the money to pay for this service. So for us to be able to find an alternative, we have to charge so that we are able to sustain the staff. But on the other hand, the clients that we expect to pay are not able to pay. So we are really in a very serious dilemma here.
Looking out into what other interventions, we're pleading that if we can get some other source of funding from anywhere else, and especially in the United States of America, as we have done previously.
You've been here for,
actually, for that.
Over a week now. Tell me what you've been doing and what the response has been from audiences you've spoken to about the global gag rule.
We have explained to our audience what is happening and the current situation in our country and what actually we're sharing with you today. And we have also been able to communicate our need, our desire, and our plea to be able to get other sources of funding. Because what we're saying essentially is, if we cannot get other means, if we cannot intervene in the right time, we are going to see a suffering country. And in the African context, we know people tend to live in very small houses. And what happens, they occasionally would have sex even by with relatives. Like an example is a young girl, a 13-year-old girl who worked in my clinic, and she had been raped by the uncle who she lives with in the slums. And so she really came and she was crying. She was suicidal and was just waiting to die. And she actually tried every means. She had taken some herbs. She didn't know what to do. And she explained that someone referred her to our clinic. And so you look at this kind of girls. It means then that in all other areas that family planning services that are not actually receiving at the moment are going through the same. Women and girls will be going through the same. They lack access to age-appropriate comprehensive education on sexuality, and so they will not be able to seek such kind of services.
How much hope do you have?
We are very hopeful that as we share our stories, we hope that this message is going to go through and convince our partners, our supporters, to come to our rescue.
Amos, you sound quite optimistic. You kind of shook your head when I asked the question, Melvin.
I'm hopeful because of the cry of a woman, the cry of a young girl, and just the fact that these women and young people will die from preventable causes. We cannot just let them die.
Amos Empano and Melvin Uyo with Family Health Options Kenya, thanks very much for coming to the studio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very
much.
So much.
Yesterday, we heard the story of Lazarat, a village in Albania that was known as Europe's pot-growing capital until police took it out of business a few years back. It's illegal to grow pot in Albania, but it still happens all across the country, and Albania continues to be a major supplier of marijuana for the rest of Europe. Here's Nate Tabak again on the front lines of Albania's war on weed.
I'm in an Albanian state police SUV. The driver, Elton, is a commander. He's a beefy guy in his early 40s with a shaved head. We're part of a small convoy in a mountainous part of the country. Soon we pass a boulder with a marijuana leaf graffitied on it.
Saw the marijuana graffiti.
Though for Elton, pot isn't a laughing matter.
Teenagers smoke too much on them.
He spends about half the year going after it. Elton soon pulls off to the side of the narrow road, our first stop. We get out and enter the dense woods. We follow a barely visible path for a few minutes, then we reach an improvised wire fence. On the other side is a garden, full of marijuana plants.
We're going to cut him, cut that.
The officers take some samples as evidence. The rest they destroy. They start by hacking the plants. Then comes the gasoline, and then it all goes up in flames. Operations like this take place all across Albania during the growing season, May to October. Most of it's in small, hard-to-find places on public land, often up in the mountains. And the growers are usually long gone before police arrive. Another officer radios in. He's on the next mountain over with a pair of binoculars, and he's found another pot farm. So we hit the road. This crackdown isn't going down well with everyone in Albania. Opposition lawmakers accuse police of selective enforcement, and in some cases outright helping growers and traffickers with government connections. Elton says he doesn't pay much attention to that.
I speak with work, you know? I cut every day plants, every day. I cut millions of euros.
We stop next to a cluster of houses and head through a field and into the woods. Soon, another small pot crop, maybe 100 plants. And so the officers get started. They cut and they burn. Meanwhile, Elton is focused on a clue. It's a hose, a few hundred feet long. It leads to a small cottage, basically abandoned, but the house next door isn't. So Elton goes to question the family. He emerges a few minutes later. His face is red. He's frustrated because the family denied knowing about the pot, and he can't do anything about it.
Do you believe that?
What do you think? I believe it.
Elton continues in Albanian. He says they went easy on the family because I'm here.
Is your hope by doing contacts like this and doing that you're discouraging people from planting? Is that kind of the...
In short, Elton says that's not the point. People know they can go to jail, and they plant anyway. But he says that by going after the little guy, the cops can get closer to the bigger players, like the large-scale traffickers.
This we're doing today is one part of our job. The other part is we are hunting for the big fish.
We start to head back to the station, but then something happens. And at this point, my recorder is turned off. But as we drive through a village called Noya, young guys sitting at a cafe start howling at the convoy, like a dog or wolf. Elton hits the brakes, and then I start recording again. Elton gets out, and he and the other officers march across the road. They're shouting. Elton threatens to take them all in. "We're just villagers," a young guy replies. Another one says the police have destroyed them with their raids. They say, why don't you focus on a big marijuana center a few hours to the south and leave us alone? It looks like they're about to come to blows, but an older man steps in and calms everyone down. The officers return to their cars.
What just happened?
The people are unhappy when we come here and react in different ways. Somebody... make like a wolf. Ooh, ooh.
Why did you decide to stop the car and talk with these guys?
To see that probably I have one wolf.
Did you find a wolf?
No.
What did you find?
There was a couple of wolves.
In other words, they found troublemakers, but no big fish. For the World, Nate Tabak, Kruja, Albania.
Nate's stories from Albania were supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. We have video of Albanian police cutting down and burning illegal pot crops at PRI.org. Now, I'm not saying that story would give anyone the munchies or anything, but this next story is about hamburgers. Okay, hamburger emojis. My BBC colleague Jonathan Savage is with a show called The Newsroom.
It was one of those massive online hoo-has, and as you'll soon understand, it's my favourite one yet. Someone spotted that Google's emoji for a burger, that's a tiny shorthand image, has the cheese at the bottom between the bun and the burger, whereas almost everyone else, Apple, WhatsApp and so on, put the cheese on the meat itself. No surprise that an issue of such importance caught the collective social media imagination and caused this programme's production meeting to descend into anarchy. So I did the noble thing and went out with a colleague to a local burger restaurant where we ordered both versions of their cheeseburger. It turned out the manager there had some pretty strong views herself.
Well, the right face obviously have the cheese on the meat. Just look at the other burger. It looks so funny having it on the bun and it's just flowing down on the paper rather than the whole burger. This is the proper way, having it on the meat and then the melted cheese is going to go down on the whole burger. It's just perfect like that.
Okay, so I'm about to taste them now and you're pretty confident that this one here with the cheese right on top of the burger is going to be tastier than this one with the cheese in the bun.
It's going to be better, definitely.
Okay, let's do it, shall we? Okay, first of all, I'm going to taste the official one that they do here with the cheese right on the burger. It's very good. Now I'm going to try the other one. This has got the cheese dripping down the bottom of the brioche bun. You know what, I agree with you. The cheese feels right on top of the burger, whereas there, it's too far away.
Exactly, and on top of that, it's going to make your bun soggy.
And it's made my fingers sticky.
And it made your fingers sticky.
You've got a bit of cheese just right there.
Thank you. Napkin, please. That's why you always take a colleague on a burger tasting assignment, Haley Thomas helping me to keep my dignity. The ending to the story is that Google has given in. It's going to fix its emoji and put the cheese on top where it belongs.
Wow, that's almost as serious as this year's West African Jollof Rice Wars. Strong views there on the placement of cheese on a burger from the BBC's Jonathan Savage. Long before the costumes and candy that are now inseparable from Halloween, this was a time of the year when people in a number of cultures thought a lot about death. It still is. That's where traditions like Mexico's Day of the Dead come from, not to mention All Souls Day, which is celebrated in many parts of the Christian world. Photographer and author Paul Kudinaris has documented the traditions in his latest book called Memento Mori, The Dead Among Us. It's filled with photos of rooms filled with human skulls and bones. And Paul, I've heard of the catacombs in Rome and Paris, actually visited one in Naples, but you found this all over the globe. What is the this we're talking about? What are these places?
Well, what this is a human compulsion to keep the dead literally among us, as in the subtitle of the book, to not push them away and kind of ghettoize them in a cemetery the way we do now in Western culture. You know, I look at death not as a biological condition, but as a boundary between two potential social groups, the living and the dead. And that if you look at death as a boundary, it becomes culturally relative. It can exist in different places. And we've created it as this kind of like in Western culture now as a Siegfried line, which you don't cross. And we don't realize how idiosyncratic and weird that is cross-culturally and historically, because it's actually traditionally it's been much more common to keep the dead around, even in physical form with the bones or the mummies, and to interact with those people, not cast them aside, but to keep them as members of the social group or even the family.
And is that boundary between life and an unknown what happens after life, is that what it's like to go into these places? Is that what you experience?
Well, I've traveled to over 70 countries and I've documented real instances where people have kept the bones and the mummies and so forth and the remains of the dead or decorated them and kept them around to be preserved and to be viewed and to be interacted with. So we're talking about a vast phenomenon. And to answer your question, coming from a Western culture where I am very used to the idea that crossing that border is really taboo. At first, it is a little unsettling, and there's a sense that, you know, are we doing something a little sinister by peering beyond the veil? But you quickly realize that this not only is normal, it's actually, how do I say it? It's actually kind of titillating and exhilarating to cross that border and to realize that for centuries, you know, it's like time kind of stood still. And especially, as you say, on this day of the year, especially when the dead were venerated, when people would visit the dead and they would interact with them. And I would look into the eye sockets of those who had preceded me, who were my relatives. And it's like I'm standing in the present. I'm standing among the past. But at the same time, I'm contemplating my own future.
So I'm looking at one picture here taken in San Martino della Battaglia, Italy. It looks like an old, austere library, beautifully crafted wood shelves, but those shelves are lined with skulls. Tell me about going to this place.
Well, that is a battle ossuary. And in the 19th century in Italy, the great days in Western culture of building the charnel houses and keeping the dead around us, it's really before the 19th century. But there was a phenomenon in the 19th century that occurred, especially in northern Italy during the Italian battles for independence, when they would dig up all the dead soldiers and place their bones inside of old churches to create, you know, sacred liminal spaces to thank those soldiers who had died for the sacrifice they had made. And there are actually several of these around northern Italy. There's San Martin, which you mentioned. There are a couple others. There's one at Custoza and Solferino. Solferino was the bloodiest battle of all. It's the one that caused the Red Cross to be founded. And all these churches still exist. And you can walk into these churches and you can pay homage to these dead soldiers while you're saying Mass.
Aren't these sacred spaces for the locals? And, you know, I mean, isn't it hard to kind of go in and just stare? I mean, you said it was kind of titillating. I mean, do you, like, you went to a place in the Philippines and you just go to this town where there's a charnel house and ask for a tour?
Well, yeah, for the most part, I do have authentically a PhD in art history. I have 3 books out about this subject matter, so it's not that hard for me to get access, because usually if I write a couple well-placed letters, someone in, especially in Europe, in the diocese office will be like, okay, this guy's for real and he has a reason to come here and study this. But it depends on the culture. A lot of these places are still open to the public. It's just that we've let them fall through the cracks of history due to our own anxiety with death. But at the same time, a lot of these places are not. And access can be very difficult. You mentioned a charnel house, which is actually a charnel cave in the Philippines called the Aptos Cave. Nearby in central Luzon, there's another site, which I'm the first outsider to local culture who was ever allowed to go to this other cave. There's a photo in the book of a couple of mummies.
And when the Spanish came over, people in central Luzon used to mummify their relatives, and they'd keep them around after death to consult with them, to get advice with them and so forth. And the Spanish said, nope, you're not doing this anymore. You got to cut out the mummification of these people. Well, they never actually stopped. They continued doing it in secret. And there's one cave in particular that they're still using, and there are still mummies in that cave. So in some cases, access is very, very difficult, and I've been very lucky to see some of these places. In other places, you mentioned the Paris catacombs. I mean, that's a tourist attraction. Anyone pays a few euros and they go in.
Some of the charnel houses are new. You went to Rwanda, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Rwanda, of course, suffered a terrible genocide, and they have made the decision, which you'd never do this in a Western country. There are a couple in the later 20th century. There are a couple new ossuaries and new collections of bones that are designed specifically to be a memorial, but also a warning and a remembrance about genocide. Several in Rwanda, also in Cambodia, so let's not forget them. Those are also in my book. And in Rwanda, they terrible, terrible instances of people who had turned to the church for protection during the genocide and tried to hide in the church, and the church had betrayed them. And so all these people who were massacred in the church later, all their bones were exhumed, and the churches were filled with not only their bones, but also their clothing. And there are these in one of the churches, the pews of the church itself are just littered with the clothing of the people who died in that church. And in some ways, that those pews filled with clothing are an even more poignant gesture to me than seeing the bones.
Paul Kudinaris, the author of Memento Mori, The Dead Among Us. We've got a gallery of his pictures at PRI.org. Paul, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Remembering our departed loved ones can be painful and sad, of course, but sometimes these remembrances are filled with celebration and music. Think the second lines at New Orleans funerals or the week-long funeral parties I went to in Togo in West Africa. It's actually common in many parts of the world, celebrating the lives of those who've died. So we leave you today with a Peruvian folk song that honors the dead. It's from the album Music of Peru, courtesy of the Smithsonian Folkways Collection as part of our collaboration with them, Future Folk. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Happy Halloween. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.